If you're going to talk about the last 30-plus years of Boston Celtics basketball, there's not a better voice to listen to than our own Mike Gorman. Hello again, I'm Abby Chin, and welcome to another edition of the 86 Celtics Interviews, extended conversations taken from CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics. Since 1981, Mike Gorman and Tommy Heinsohn have led our station's coverage as the home of the Celtics. That season proved to be the first of what now stands as four championship teams that Gorman has broadcasted. The director of our documentary, Tori Champagne, sat down with Mike to talk about the 1986 team. But first, we go back to that feeling around the Celtics before the season, after losing to the Lakers in the finals in 1985.
That was very difficult. The Celtics and the Lakers at that time in NBA history had become the two franchises. They were the Red Sox, Yankees. Those were the games everybody wanted to see. Those were the games that showed up on national TV on Sunday afternoon. And then they used to joke about nobody watched the playoffs until the Celtics and Lakers got to the final, and then they would do it. So I think people thought, the way the Celtics had played the year before, that they wouldn't have any problem with the Lakers going into that season. I shouldn't say not have any problem, that's a little bit of a stretch, but they knew they were the two best teams in basketball and they felt they were going to meet again. The crusher, of course, was Magic, with that hook shot across the lane at the big moment that just deflated the whole building, as quiet as I've ever seen the Boston Garden get from being raucous 2 minutes before that. But it was a question of two teams that really separated themselves from everybody else and didn't just do it in terms of reputation, did it on the court. Both teams won a ton of games. They didn't lose much. The Celtics were something like 40-1 at home during that stretch. So the disappointment in Boston was pretty big. I don't remember what the Red Sox followed up with that particular year, where they took the mind away from the sports fan, didn't have to worry about the Celtics. But it all became about Walton. It all became about improving the team.
I was going to say the summer of Walton, it seems like and nowadays you'd find it on Twitter every 3 seconds, an update. Yeah. But at that time, it just wasn't, the news cycle was a lot slower. Like, how much buzz was there about Walton that you recall during that offseason?
There was a great deal of buzz about Walton, because the whole idea of putting Walton together with Larry Bird just appealed to every basketball aficionado. These were two guys who really understood how to play the game. Now they were going to suddenly play together. Bill is a good friend of mine and is a very likable character, but marches to the beat of his own drum. So there was no lock that he was going to get here. So it was an anxious summer for Celtic fans. Anxious because the whole thought, again, of Larry Bird and Bill Walton playing together was just too much for basketball fans.
Tell me a little bit about your friend Bill Walton. I mean, everybody kind of knows now that he's a character. How much at that time?
Well, he was still pretty much a character at that time. You know, I mean, he's the original Deadhead, I think, at least in the Hall of Fame of Deadheads, following the Grateful Dead around. But it was real music junkie, liked to go to concerts. I don't only go back to the Hall of Fame ceremonies that Tommy just was recently in. Bill showed up in a golf shirt and a pair of sneakers. And everybody didn't take any umbrage at it at all, even though everybody else was very formally dressed. It's just kind of Bill being Bill. Fought through a lot of problems with his back. Spent a couple of years there where people didn't know whether he was going to walk again, let alone be out in the public again. But he's back, and he's Bill, and he's just one of a kind.
I was curious about, you know, like you were saying about Walton's character, and people kind of understand and associate him with the Deadhead and the kind of player he was. But at the time, you know, with Bird being such a prolific, tough guy and solid shooter, where did Walton kind of rank in the NBA, just to give people a perspective with what kind of player he was, or the caliber of player?
Healthy, a top five player in the league, no question about it. And I think, played the game the way it should be played, and that was a big appeal to Larry Bird, to be out there with guys who were playing the game the same way he saw the game. Those two were very good friends. They talked basketball all the time. And again, Larry had great players around him, obviously, and Kevin and Danny and Chief and DJ. But Walton was special. And, you know, Walton showed it when he was healthy in Portland, what he could do when they beat the Sixers. But injuries shortened what would have been a wonderful, wonderful career. But because he was so intelligent, because he played the game so smartly, he could overcome those injuries by playing angles as opposed to foot speed. And again, was a think pass guy first, and those guys always got along very well with Bird.
I guess the other part of it is you know, the Bird mentality, being the trash talker. I mean, it was different then, but I guess how intense was the trash talk from the collective 86 team? That kind of the Danny Ainge needling people, those yeah, types of personalities.
Danny would talk. Chief didn't talk much. Kevin McHale a little. Larry was the instigator. And you know, we were sitting up in the overhang, which was a great place to broadcast a game, but didn't afford you the luxury of being courtside and hearing what the players are actually saying. But if you look at old footage of Larry often had something to say after he made a basket, after he made a play. You know, was he the greatest trash talker of all time? A lot of people think he was the most consistent trash talker of all time because he trash talked all the time.
Did that carry over with the rest of the guys, though? Did you think that his attitude kind of...
I think his attitude carried over. I don't think the actual trash talk did. Certainly not with Robert Parrish, who never said much of anything. Kevin was relatively quiet. And Dennis was not really much of a talker. Danny and Larry would have been the two guys. But Larry kind of made up for everybody.
Was this the best passing team that you've ever seen?
Oh, with Walton, it was unbelievable. Yeah. You know, I mean, Larry was such a good passer and was always thinking pass first. Except in critical situations, then he wanted to shoot the ball. But most of the game, he spent thinking pass first, and so did Bill. So you had two guys out there whose prime identity was to get touches and move the ball and keep it flying around. So, yeah, they were a joy to watch, and literally a joy for me to watch, because we hung in that first overhang, broadcast from that first overhang of the old Boston Garden, the techniques underneath us. So you were about 15 feet high, maybe about 18 to 20 feet off the court. So you could see everything was in your field of vision. There were no referees in the way. There were no players looking to come into the game or sit in front of you sometimes in the broadcast position if you're right by the bench. So it was and remains to this day for me the best broadcast location I was ever in. The one drawback was you couldn't hear. And unless you had a really good audio guy on the games who could give you the mics, they weren't even sophisticated in those days, that they would put on the baskets. You could see Larry talking, but you couldn't hear what Larry was saying, which is probably good that we didn't hear what he was saying.
Being at home, you know, the Garden's not there anymore. It's a time and a place now that I don't think people fully understand if they never had been there.
Right.
Can you kind of describe what it was like that season, their home record, just their, like, kind of utter dominance at home? And at that, it seemed like it was the height of everything.
It was the ticket. You know, the Celtics, back with Garnett, Pierce, and Allen, got to that point again of being the ticket. But for Larry's pretty much his whole career, and especially in 86 when they were so good, it was the ticket to be, it was the place to be if the Celtics were playing that night. So every suit from the financial district, everybody who had any pull, every politician, any movie star or two-bit actor or actress who was in town, they wanted to be at the Celtic games. So it became very much a happening as much as it became a basketball game. And I think they went 40-1, and we just... You knew going to the game, you were going to have a good time. The Celtics were going to win. Bird was going to do something you had never seen before. Danny was going to get in trouble. There were all these little side stories that were going on. And it really became an on-running show. It really, when you think about it, was the precursor of NBA entertainment, or NBA being viewed as entertainment as well as a sporting event. Because Michael was coming into his own at that time. Magic still had his game. Larry still had his game. So the league was building the teams, not on the laundry anymore, but on the reputations of individual players. And there probably were more great individual players, Hakeem Olajuwon, guys floating around the league in the late 80s. So you'd get good competition every night, and the Celtics would win, and it was pretty much guaranteed. It was a nice way to spend an evening.
The you used the term raucous crowd a little bit ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, how compared to today's arenas that you're in on a regular basis, yeah, what was the atmosphere like in that building at that time?
It was a great atmosphere in the sense that it was an old building. It echoed everything, echoed in there. You weren't too far back. The building didn't spread out like this. The building more went up like that. So even if you were in the second balcony, you were looking down. It was a great crowd. And you know, I spent a lot of time when I was a kid in the second balcony. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to leave the second balcony who get the opportunity to come down because it's a whole culture that they have up there. So, yeah, it was the place to be in Boston for most of the 80s, but especially in 86. It was everybody understood, was beginning to understand that this wasn't going to last forever. Larry was having back problems. Kevin was having some physical problems. And so you knew this was slowly going to break down. But this was indeed the last hurrah.
One more question about the building, just in that time frame. I mean, the garden had all these mystique about it, or these stories made up, or, you know, Red put a hex on the other locker room, or whatever it would be. It seemed to be heightened during that time because they were just so dominant and so good that, you know, the teams were starting to kind of buy into that again, you know. And I guess, you know, recently with the Patriots, you kind of see this mentality that they're so good that everybody's looking for how they're cheating or what the advantage is or what the edge could possibly be.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question the Celtics used different things as an edge. I mean, people used to say that Dennis Johnson knew where every dead spot on the floor was, and he would force his guy into the dead spot, knowing the dribble would not come back up as fast as he could, and he would make a lot of his steals. Whether that was true or not, I don't know. But it was a good story. The Garden, of course, had character. It had been there forever. You would walk up these wide tunnels to get there. There were no stairways. It was all because the circus and all these other people used to perform in there, and you used to have to get their stuff in and out. Occasionally, we'd come back from a road trip and have a game after the circus, and it was gamey, shall we say, in the Garden. And, you know, of course, when the Celtics played the Lakers in the summertime, there was no air conditioning. Some say there was air conditioning in the home locker. There wasn't in the visiting locker. You're right, though, in that to this day, Pat Riley does not like the Celtics. There are a lot of, you know, very successful basketball guys out there who you would think would say, well, I can admire what they did. No.
When Bird, the All-Star game, the three-point contest, and he kind of shakes a finger and predicts that he's going to win, you know, do you recall it, and is it just... Was that just Larry? I mean, you were around the team so much. Was that just typical Larry?
Typical Larry, yeah. I mean, Larry was as sure of himself as any player I've ever been around. Understood the game of basketball, understood how it should be played. You know, people used the old line that he was playing chess, everybody else was playing checkers. But that was true. You know, from the time he walked out on the court, he was looking to gain an edge one way or another on his opponent. And that made Dennis Johnson hungrier. That made Kevin McHale hungrier. You know, I mean, there's a great story that happened when McHale set the Celtics scoring record, and Larry said, enjoy it, because in a couple of weeks I'm going to take it back, and did, just as he predicted in the three-point contest, who is going to walk in the locker room, and allegedly he said, who's coming in second here today? But that's, you know, Larry, for a guy who we've got to know now in a different way as a general manager and is kind of soft-spoken and really is not a forceful personality by any stretch, was as forceful a personality as any player I've ever seen when he was on the court.
The thing about Larry, too, is that it was always basketball. Do you recall, like, ever after the game or being around the media scrums? I've seen clips where he could just, you could ask him anything about the game and he could just recite it, what just happened. Was that
all the great players I've ever been around can do that. They can bump into somebody. I've been with players and somebody will come up to them and say, hey, I played against you 20 years ago at St. Joe's or something. And the player would go, oh, sure, sir, and then as you turn away, he turns to me and goes, I got 35 off that guy. You know, they remember every game. They just do. I guess it's because it's who they are, and it's how they're defined. And certainly, the bigger you become, the more you become defined that way. But the common thread I find to just about every really great player is you can say, do you remember that fourth game against Philly 6 years ago in the playoffs? And they're like, yeah. Yeah, they do.
I know that, you know, the season probably is just a giant blur, but they were so dominant for such a long stretch in 86 from February until the playoffs. Mm-hmm. Did you ever sit up there with Tommy and just shake your head like, are they going to lose one? Are they going to drop one? Are they going to, you know, what are we doing here?
Yeah, it's where I learned that you're a good broadcaster if your team wins, you know, and that made me and Tommy good. It was fun. I mean, it was such a night in Boston. Those Wednesdays and Friday nights were almost consistent on the schedule. You always played on Wednesday, Friday. And again, you just blocked off every Wednesday, Friday in the second half of the year. It's like, this is where I want to be. If I can be anywhere in the city on this night, I want to be at the Celtics game. And the Celtics, during that stretch, I'd have to go back and look this up, but it seemed to me they just jumped on people early. They didn't play a lot of tight games. You look at that 41 stretch at home, the average margin of victory was probably about 9 or 10 points. And I can remember so many games where the Celtics would get in front by 15 in the first quarter, lead by 12 at the half, stretch it to 17 in the third, win by 14. So the game was all decided in the first 12 minutes of the game. They would just come out, and they would come ready to play every day, right at the opening tip. That was Bird, because I mean, if you weren't ready to play, he'd embarrass you with a pass or make you look bad out there to get you into the game. So the first quarters and first halves were what you want to see. People actually started leaving towards the end because they had seen this play out so many times before. Everybody says you got to watch the last 12 minutes of an NBA basketball game. In those days, you wanted to watch the first 12 minutes of the basketball game because that's when it was being played at its best.
In relation to the dominance, do you think, looking back, could this team really have won 70 if they kind of had buckled down in a couple of places?
Yeah, I don't think they were so concerned about that. Could they have? Yeah. By now, this team was firmly entrenched in the idea they want to win an NBA championship. They want to get to the playoffs. Regular season did not hold a lot of appeal. Again, it was before the charter days of flying. It was a long grind. So the whole goal began just to get through it. And I think that was one of the reasons that the coaching staff was able to use on the players. It's like, you know, go get a 12, 15-point lead as quickly as you can in this game, and then you can kind of go into cruise control. And that's what they were very, very good at doing. Could they have won 70? I suppose if they had set their mind to it, but I never remember hearing any of the players say this was a priority or this was a goal. I just wanted to win the next game.
With that cast of characters and kind of veteran presence and, you know, the MVP of the league, with Casey being the coach, how different was it, you know, you being around the team so often mm-hmm. for all those years and kind of being through that era, how did things change when Casey came in as a coach and, you know, he had the reputation as the player's coach? You know, was that kind of accurate or is that kind of blown out of
proportion? No, it was very accurate.
Okay.
Very accurate. He was very much a player's coach. I think the NBA is a league, I hope Brad Stevens proves me wrong on this, but I think the NBA is a league where you almost want your coach to be a former player. You want your coach to have gone through what players go through so they'll understand them. Doc being a great example of that. Casey was like that. He was a guy who had played. He had their respect. I mean, Casey had a remarkable run of, the last 2 years at University of San Francisco. They won NCAA championships. Then he went and won a gold medal. Then he came back and won like six or seven championships and then retired. He went like 8 years where they won the last game they played. And that's always the goal when you talk to these guys. What do you want? We want to win the last game we play because they want that last game, obviously, to be in the NBA Finals. So Casey was a perfect fit. He, as Tommy talked about, he was open to suggestions. He would listen to players. He just didn't come in with the set rules that you have to go by. That's pretty smart when you have, four Hall of Famers on your team. It's probably a good idea to listen.
The fact that, once again, it's kind of comparable to the Patriots. You kind of have this run with Brady. You know, I guess the closest thing Boston has had was Bird, and more so in so many ways. The idea that he had continued to get, he had gotten his third straight MVP. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine a player dominating the NBA mm-hmm. three straight years like that. I mean, mm-hmm. your recollection of just how dominant his performance was in that stretch.
Well, unlike a lot of guys who just dominated the league by scoring, he did everything. And more importantly, he did what was needed in that particular game. I mean, I don't think Larry ever went out saying, I'm going to get 25 tonight. He might tell the guys trying to cover him, he's going to get 25 tonight, but that was just Larry being Larry. He just wanted to win the game. So if it meant he had to get 15 rebounds, if it meant he had to get 12 assists, if it meant he had to get 4 steals, he would do it. So, you know, I haven't seen a player since. I have seen a player since, actually. Michael and Larry dominated the games in that period of time. Then we had a long gap of guys that weren't as dominant. Now we have another one in LeBron who is as dominant. And where LeBron dominates the game physically, it was more a cerebral thing with Larry. You know, he didn't, he was where you were going before you got there. Again, it's that whole chess and checkers thing. So it was fun to watch him as dominant as he was at the peak of his game. But again, towards the end of 86, the back injuries were starting to pile up and his back was starting to become a problem. And, you know, none of us realized it then that we had seen the best.
Heading into the playoffs, they face the Bulls and there's, you know, here's this kid, Michael Jordan.
Right. Big
assuming,
night.
I was going to say, I'm assuming you were at that game. Yeah. I'm assuming you were there.
I broadcast that game.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you take me through a game when you're kind of maybe getting the unexpected in a broadcast like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it was. It was unexpected because even though we got off to a quick start and build and build, you were saying he can't keep this up, and he did keep this up to the tune of, what, 63, I think is what he had, which still is an NBA playoff record, I believe. So yeah, that went down sideways with Larry and some of the guys that he would be getting this off of the Celtics. And the Celtics won the game, but Michael certainly won the moment. And you know, I always felt that was really Michael's coming out. That was where people understood, wow, this guy can be really, really special. He's just not a scorer. He can do a lot of different things, but if he wants to be a scorer, he can get 60 on you. So that game stands out. I remember it very well. It would have been a bigger deal if Chicago had won the game, because it was kind of like, he got 63, but he lost. And that's all the Celtics cared about, was the win. So, and if I remember correctly, as I looked down some notes here, it was a fairly short series against Chicago, 4-1, yep. Yeah. So the Celtics weren't afraid of Michael Jordan. They didn't think Michael Jordan could single-handedly beat them, but he showed that he could single-handedly take them to two overtimes.
I mean, Jordan at that time, too, I mean, he's very new to the league.
Yes.
So I don't think you kind of hit upon it, but I guess were you surprised by the
situation? You know, this is heresy to say. I was not a believer in Michael when he first came along. I thought, yeah, he's athletic and he's more athletic than most, and he's a scorer. But when I first saw Michael, I thought, well, he's going to be like an 18 to 20 point a game guy consistently, but it's not going to turn out to be what he was. And what you couldn't see early was what a competitor he was, and how hard he played the game, and how he looked around and he saw that the guys who were doing very well in the game, Bird and Magic being primarily the two, were guys who thought the game through, didn't rely on their physical ability to carry them through, thought the game through. And I always thought that with Michael, after he put on the show and sent out this calling card that he could get 63 in a big game, in a playoff game, he also realized he lost that series 4-1, and maybe he could get 30 and we could win a game. So I you know, I've never talked to Michael about this, but I think that might have changed his attitude a little bit, getting swamped by a team that just crisply moved the ball around, didn't care who got the shot. Now, in Michael's defense, he didn't have three Hall of Famers out there with him too. But yeah, I think it was a turning point probably for Michael, in that, if I'm going to get 70 and lose, it's no good.
The thing that always sticks out to me is Bird after the game saying that was God dressed as Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Larry didn't throw around comments.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. You know, for him to say that, especially in the midst of a playoff, in the midst of a season where they're completely dominant, that was kind of unique to hear Bird in that atmosphere say something like that.
Well, I would guess that Larry never played on a team that somebody dropped 63 on them before in his life. You know, he was usually the guy dropping the big number on somebody else. So, I think those are strong words from Larry, but on that particular night, they fit.
From your recollection of that Atlanta team, or the Dominique, kind of the height of, almost the height of the Dominique era in some ways, what was your kind of recollection of that series as a whole? Do you kind of remember it in any sense?
Michael had better supporting cast than Dominique had, I thought. But that was a case where you knew Dominique wasn't going to beat you. Would be very entertaining to watch. Would probably have a 30-plus night. Would probably have a couple of dunks that really lit people up. The Celtics were a very coldly confident bunch. They thought they were the best team in basketball, bar none, and they didn't think there was anybody really out there who could challenge that. So, again, for Dominique and Michael, it became two series of being able to show off their individual skills, but for the Celtics, it was just two more steps to get further down the line. And Dominique, as I remember, was pretty much overwhelmed because he didn't have the supporting cast. He could be Dominique, but couldn't win.
It was kind of the same thing against the Bucks. It was just another series. It was almost, I don't know, I guess you could tell me, did it seem as though we just got to get through this one to get to where we want to go?
Yes, without question. You know, I mean, again, you know, the Celtics to this day, and I really admire them for this, other teams talk the talk but don't really walk the walk. The Celtics are championship-driven. They're not looking to make the playoffs. They're not looking to, like, gee, we get into the second round, isn't that nifty? They want to win, you know, and We got a guy in Danny who really only counts winning. If you don't win the whole championship, then obviously you haven't done your job, and you got to go back and do your job better. So if you have that attitude and you get players to buy into that attitude, then, yeah, I mean, I can remember with that team, I did go out on a few road games and we covered them through most of the playoffs. They liked nothing better than walking into a really loud building and just quieting people down. They loved it, and they thought they could do it anywhere. I never saw in all my time with that team or with the Pierce, Garnett, and Allen team, I never saw any creases or dents in the self-confidence level. They thought they were the best. They were going to show you they were the best. And if on one particular night you happen to get lucky and win, we'd beat your brains out the next night.
The NBA Finals, I think one of the great things looking back on the 80s era is just there was the nicknames, the different aspects in there of these players that seemed larger than life. It was kind of the height of the NBA, like mm-hmm. you said, with Magic Bird, Michael. But Houston had the Twin Towers and mm-hmm. Ralph Sampson and Olajuwon. What was kind of, looking back, you know, how much of a threat did they really pose in what you had seen of them, and what was kind of the sense going into that series?
Well, I know, and if there was a good X and O guy sitting beside me here, he probably could point out some things they did. Again, I think it was much more a question of Boston knew they were better. One of the things, I remember talking a lot with Doc about this, that he agreed that Celtic teams of the 80s were like this, and he wanted his teams to be like this, is they just believe they're better. And they believe, like, yeah, I'm going to scout you, and I'm going to realize what you're going to do, but first you're going to have to stop what I do. And I do this better than anybody else out there, and I don't think you can stop us. So the Twin Tower concept, the press made a lot of it. I don't think the Celtics did a whole lot really to adjust who they were to try to play the Twin Towers. It was much more, they're not fast, we'll run, we'll pick on their weaknesses. But we will say how the game is going to be played. You won't say how the game is going to be played. That's the biggest thing I remember about that team.
The fact that Houston had bumped off the Lakers as a, you know, the NBA world in Boston, mm-hmm. how disappointed was everybody that there was no Lakers Celtics?
Very.
Yeah.
I mean, we were running on a string of Lakers. Didn't matter what happened for the NBA for all those other guys. When it came to push came to shove, it was going to be the Lakers and the Celtics every year. And, you know, the Celtics were looking for payback, were ready for payback, felt that they could beat L.A. So, yeah, I think if the guys were honest, I think they would tell you there was some disappointment that they beat Houston. I mean, they, again, emerged as world champions, and that's the stated goal at the beginning of the year. But instead of seeing Olajuwon walk down the corridor with his head down, they wanted to see Magic walk down the corridor with his head down.
They win the title. You know, it solidifies the big three. It solidifies mm-hmm. this entire new reign of Celtics dominance. Did you realize in the moment, you know, really at that point, what was taking place for that franchise? I mean, obviously you'd been there for other championships and been around mm-hmm. it, but really to see that come together that quickly in the 80s and be part of that and kind of see 86 happen and the continuation of this dynasty and this legacy, did it hit you at that point? Did you kind of take that in at that moment when they had won, how big this dynasty has spanned?
Yeah, you were always worried about when it was going to end because it's such a tentative life as a player. And I think with the charter travel and everything that goes on now, you can extend a player's career by a couple of years. But then you were playing games and you were going back to the hotel and you were all charged up and you couldn't get to sleep. And then you had a 5:30 wake-up call to get on a bus to go to a commercial flight and get to a city and play that night. I think we all saw that taking its toll on Kevin, on Larry, on Robert. And so I think there was, for me anyway, there was more of a feeling after 86 that I've seen the best for a while. It's just not going to be as good. And there's plenty of reasons for it. It's not like anybody's not doing their job and not doing what they're supposed to do. But guys are getting old, and the wear and tear of playing 5 or 6 or 7 NBA seasons gets to you. The travel is what gets to you. It's not, I mean, all players, their bodies eventually break down naturally. But it's the travel that over the course of 5 or 6 or 7 years wears on you and was wearing on them at the end of 86.
Kind of looking at the subsequent years after, made your job a lot harder for a couple of years. But the kind of this dynasty having such an extended lifetime and being so successful in producing some of the greatest players to ever play the game, And then suddenly there's this collective loss. There's the loss of Len Bias. There's mm-hmm. the loss in 88. Then not too long later, Larry goes down, and then they lose Reggie. It's just this mm-hmm. really kind of dark period right after the horizon. I guess, does every empire have to fall? Does the empire have to kind of go through these dark days? Or was that almost too much to bear? It just seemed like one blow after the other.
No, it was, you knew you were going to have to pay for all the good eventually. I mean, very rarely do you see a dynasty go out on top. Dynasties, as you say, tend to crumble slowly. So, 86 for me was when that was them at their very best. As time went on, you just knew people were missing games, people were hurt, you could watch them walking around, you knew things weren't right, you knew Larry was, his back was really giving him problems. The Celtic ownership, and interesting, Danny went through this as a player and made an opposite decision to trade Kevin Garnett, to trade Paul Pierce and let Ray Allen go. Dave Gavitt at that time, I believe he was the guy, did not want to do that, did not want to let them. He thought he was loyal, and he thought these players should retire as Celtics, which they did. But then when the complication of Len Bias and Reggie Lewis suddenly hit, you had no more players. And it took us a long time to build back up.
It was, to go from the ticket in town and then...
To the scalper.
Yeah. I guess, was that kind of, for you, I mean, the fans yeah. might have went away, but you were still there every night,
Yeah, I was. I mean, but, my favorite line is I would have people come up to me and say, you used to be Mike Gorman. And I'm like, yes, I was back in the 80s, but now I'm not anymore.
Not to belabor the dark days, but one of the things we want to illustrate is just, I think it's one of those elements, and you've kind of hit upon it, but you don't know what you got until it's gone. And for this generation, or the generation younger than me, they don't even know what it was. Right. What I mean? They don't understand what the 80s were or how significant that was in the context of NBA history. Mm-hmm. I guess to go through the 90s and through the 2000s and then finally have a little bit of a glimpse of that again and to mm-hmm. reclaim it and be part of that, going through that stretch, I guess the question is when you finally did get to see the Celtics kind of return to glory in the sense of the Pierce and Garnett and the new Big Three era, how much of that struck with you that you kind of felt that 86, that 80s vibe again?
Very much so. An attitude that I don't know if anybody on the 86 team ever necessarily told anybody on the Pierce Garnett team this, but their attitudes were very similar. They almost like to play. They loved home, they loved the garden, but they liked to play road games, like to go into people's buildings and give them a beating. They had that attitude. We were just the toughest guys on the block. And we went a long time where we weren't the toughest guys on the block. There were ownership changes, there were changes in the front office, there was never really a consistency through the 90s into the early 2000s until Doc came back, or not came back, until Doc arrived.
To look back on it, I guess, and look back on that era of player and that caliber of player and that assembly of that starting five. You had such a unique cast of characters in that starting five alone, never mind Walton being the sixth man. Mm-hmm. I always think of that five-star picture where the five of them are standing around the trophy that mm-hmm. I think it's in the Hall of Fame case. Those personalities, do you see or feel that can never be reclaimed, that era of the players could just kind of be who they were? I feel like today's mm-hmm. NBA is a little bit different.
Yeah, I think LeBron is trying to do that in Cleveland. He's trying to surround himself with quality people as opposed to I'll take all the money, the Carmelo approach, and I'll take all the money under the salary cap and play with a bunch of guys who are less than good. I don't know whether that can ever be really recaptured. The first piece you have to have is your best player has to have that unselfish attitude, has to put winning first and put all other statistics aside. Because one thing I learned very quickly when the first 15 years I did this, I only did the Celtic games at home. And then Red and Tommy and a couple of other people, Gil Santos, other people did some away games. And I would go do college basketball. And people would say to me, what's the biggest difference between college basketball? And I said, well, other than the fact we're talking about men over here and boys over here, in college, teams take on the personality of their coach. In the NBA, teams take on the personality of the best player. So if your best player is a fruitcake, you get a bad team. If your best player is very, very good, understands how to play the game, is Tim Duncan's a great example of that. Tim Duncan is the personality of the San Antonio Spurs, and they continue to win. I think LeBron is building something in Cleveland right now where he will have a good, he's not afraid to play with Kyrie Irving, he's not afraid to play with Love, guys who have big reputations, because he can be bigger than them all by being, he's one of the best passers in the league to keep everybody happy. So that is what it comes down to me, is I always look at who the best player is on a team that we're playing and find out as much as I can about his personality, because that's the personality the team will have.
And then the last question for you, Mike, is just Boston as a city and that time. The Bruins weren't really there. The Red Sox were in and out, mm-hmm. and just the mm-hmm. Red Sox. Patriots go to the Super Bowl and get crushed. They were definitely the ticket in town, but how much of the celebration and the attitude and the focus on the city when they did come home for a parade or whatever, what do you recall about that kind of excitement around Boston, the rock star mentality, I guess, of the Bird and the Big Three?
Yeah, as we talked about, it was the place to be when they were playing at home. We lived in a day of age that there was no Twitter. So word would spread out from the Garden if the Celtics played that night. Now, if the Celtics play and I walk back in, go into a bar, for instance, the guy behind the bar knows the Celtics have won the game, probably knows the other scores around the whole league. That was what you used to get in the morning with the morning newspaper. So there was a real excitement about the Celtics because they were winning, and it would spread out from the building. After you left, you went to a restaurant, you went somewhere, and people were like, hey, how'd we do tonight? You know, so that is in Boston, people, they don't I've told people before this is my theory on it, is fans don't stop rooting for the Celtics. They just take a rest if the Celtics aren't very good. And they'll be back when we start to be good. We're seeing that right now. Fans are coming back strong to this team because the word is out there that this team plays hard and this team plays well and play together. That's what we used to say about the team in 86, plays hard, plays well, plays together. So there's a nice renaissance, long-winded answer to your question. There's a nice renaissance going on in Boston right now with the Celtics. I would make a case the Celtics right now, given the state of the Red Sox, are probably second to the Patriots in terms of curiosity. People want to see how good they can be. People weren't saying that 10 years ago.
Thanks to Mike Gorman for sitting down with us to talk about the 1986 Celtics, among other topics. Again, make sure to look for new episodes of the 86 Celtics interviews every Tuesday and Thursday on CSNNE.com. You can also subscribe on our iTunes feed or look for us on other podcasting apps. I am Abby Chin, and we will see you on the next episode of the 86 Celtics interviews.